So tonight I want to talk about death and rebirth and life. And if we have time, we'll get into some more serious topics. And I actually started thinking about this because of a death in the family. Although that really had nothing to do with what I ended up talking about. First, I want to do a little gripe about terminology, rebirth versus reincarnation. I thought these pretty much meant the same, and about 5 or 6 years ago, I was teaching an introductory course to Buddha Dharma and meditation. I used the word reincarnation, and a good friend took me aside and said, all of the monks and the scholars are now using the word rebirth, so reincarnation is a no-no, don't use that. So I got home, much abashed, because you don't want to go against the monks, do you? So I looked it up in the OED and in another dictionary that I like a lot, and when you read the definition of rebirth, it refers to reincarnation. You go look up reincarnation, it refers to rebirth. So, and maybe they have slightly different connotations. To me, they're close enough. They're both a little bit creepy when you think about them. Especially reincarnation. It's sort of like returning to being meat when you think about it. So the Buddha often talked about rebirth, and he probably believed it. It was certainly widely believed in his time, but not universally believed. So the question comes up, what is it that gets reborn if you are a believer in rebirth? So this gets kind of tricky. If you're a Hindu, it's a soul that's reborn, and the term is atta, it's atman in Sanskrit. So there's a sense of there being individual souls or atmans, and then there's sort of an oversoul, atman, and your goal is eventually to rejoin this super-duper soul because it's much better than your little soul. Now, the Buddha rejected that. And by the way, this belief also was common in other areas. The early Greeks, the pre-Socratics, many of them also believed in reincarnation. Now, we're not made aware of that, unfortunately, in our philosophical history courses. But it's true. There was a great deal of cross-pollination of ideas going on between India and the Mediterranean world. We don't really know whether these ideas originated in India or whether they originated somewhere in the Middle East and percolated out to other regions. But the Buddha rejected the idea of a soul being reborn. And in fact, anatta, the word that's usually translated as not self or no self, atta is the Pali word, the equivalent of atman. So anatta, you can translate as no soul. It turns out that the Buddha was saying something more radical than just that there is no soul. He explicitly renounced the idea of there being a soul or a super soul. But he also quite often talked about there being no self, although we'll come back to that. So if anatta is true, if there isn't really a self that's reborn lifetime to lifetime, then you've got a problem. What is it that gets reborn? Or who is it that gets reborn if there isn't something that moves from this life to the next life? So a number of teachers have come up with interesting ways of stating that. Ajahn Sumedho says, what's reborn is your bad habits. It's also stated that your karma is what's reborn. I think this is more specifically what the Buddha taught when he obliquely addressed the question. And karma is your actions and their consequences. There is, by the way, if you're into the Abhidhamma, there is a very detailed breakdown in the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma has this sense of there being, in every mind instant, it's actually broken down into 17 mind sub-instants. Sort of like molecules versus atoms. very, very complicated. The Abhidhamma will keep you busy for a long time. The Abhidhamma is often called the Buddhist psychology. It's very analytical, and it's also something what it was first written down somewhat later than the rest of the Pali Canon. And in fact, while the Pali Canon, the other two parts, the rules of the monastic order and the collections of discourses, show up in very similar, almost identical versions in Chinese. There are two different versions that show up in Chinese. They were transmitted in Sanskrit through the Silk Road to China. So we can look at them and say, wow, these are really shockingly similar. A few differences like, oh, the Buddha had different monks with him on a particular trip, or he gave a particular talk in a different place. These traditions all have Abhidhammas as well, which are like elaborate commentaries or systematizations of the Buddha's teachings, but they're all different. So Abhidhamma is a little iffier. Anyway, this is a bit of an aside, but there are 17 mind moments within each mind event, and there are zillions of mind events in any period of time. And there's the Abhidhamma actually states which of these instants at death is the one that the karma is transmitted in and moves up, off to some other body. It's very specific stuff. If you're a wonk, it's a lot of fun. I find it a little hard to take it seriously, and it really became a whole orthodoxy in and of itself, and later movements sort of rejected that to try to move back to sort of what they saw as basic Buddhism. So another thing that teachers say about rebirth is that what's reborn is suffering. So maybe it's not you that's being reborn, but your suffering is. All your bad habits are being reborn. So the compassionate thing to do is to have better karma, because you want to leave less suffering in the world. You want less suffering to get reborn. So you try to polish up your karma so that there's just everything is better in general. But I think there's sort of a problem here, because it's sort of like, you know, why worry? It's somebody else's problem. I can just throw my karma over the fence, make it somebody else's problem. So I'm not quite satisfied with that either. Ajahn Amaro says, it's not a thing that's being reborn. It's an ongoing process that's taking place. And I like this better. It's a lot like dependent origination, that the radical independence of all things, there is no object in the world, that it's all a set of interlocking and interdependent processes. And this is something I like a lot. It's also a lot like Whiteheadian theology. Whitehead, who was a hugely important thinker in the West, also saw things as being a set of elaborate processes rather than as objects. And if you want to learn more about Whitehead, who's a fascinating guy, we have a Whiteheadian expert over here in Barbara McHugh.
No, just an ongoing process.
But if this is true, if it's just a set of impersonal processes, then where do my choices come in? If I'm just part of some vast collection of ongoing processes, does my volition count at all? So what's the meaning of karma in this kind of context? Because the Buddha did talk about free will and karma, that we do have responsibility for our future happiness. And that sounds personal. It sounds very personal when he says that you have responsibility for your karma and for your future happiness. So in a way, you have not self on the one hand, but on the other hand, you are the owner of your karma, which shows up over and over again. So I think we do have to look at what's personal and what's impersonal, what is self and what's not self. So it means we have to take a look at the topic of anatta, aka no self. So a little digression here, but you'll see that it's significant. The Buddha talked, well, actually the Buddha didn't talk about three characteristics. That formulation showed up later, that there are fundamentally three characteristics to existence. That it turns out that the Buddha talked about all three of these phenomena. He took them very seriously and talked about them a lot. It was later on that they were put together as the big three. So the three characteristics, I'm going to, in no particular order, because there's no specific order in any teaching that I can determine, but I'll mention dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering. That sounds very Gothic to me. I actually prefer things like stress, anxiety, unease, angst, which can be very subtle. I like to use the example of somebody sitting on a tropical beach with a piña colada in one hand. There's a sunset. It's beautiful. Oh, I wish this could last forever. I really deserve this. I should do this more often. So we've already created a story about ourselves sitting at the beach. We've already introduced friction. No matter how much we think we're enjoying it now, it's sort of like we've added this subtle unease already. And it's because we've created a story about ourselves. And so it's time for me to mention the second arrow, which most of us know about. Second arrow is where we take the first arrow. The first arrow is inevitable. We fall down and we hurt our knee. A loved one dies. We read about something that we don't like in the newspaper. We're worried about our overdue library book. Stuff just happens. It's inevitable. And that's the first arrow. The second arrow is when we take the first arrow and make it personal. When we come up with a story about it. And this is huge. It turns out that for certain kinds of chronic pain, and I don't know the methodology for this study, but up to 80% of our perceived suffering for some kinds of physical pain is actually the second arrow, the story that we make up, rather than the actual physical pain. And, you know, many of us have used this technique of when you have a pain, you try to get rid of the story about it and focus on the actual physical sensation, and you often find it's not that bad. Or you do something smart to help the pain. It's not like we're trying to suffer. But if you can cut down on the story, you can do a lot to alleviate that pain. But the second arrow is, I think, when we take the first arrow and we make it personal by making a story around it. And when it's personal, we get clinging. It's the second noble truth. First noble truth is there's suffering. The second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is clinging. And I think you can't have clinging without a self. No self, no problem. So self is a really big deal in dukkha. So next I'll mention anicca, or impermanence. So you can sort of see where I'm going with anicca. Impermanence itself is not the problem. It's our personal relationship to impermanence that is the problem, because it's all about us. We want things to be stable. Once we get something that we like, we want it to stay there. Once we get something we don't like, we don't want it to stay there. So it's very personal. And then the third one is anatta, or the whole thing about self or not self. As one teacher says, you can't count on anything, and that really sucks, but don't take it personally. So as anatta is traditionally taught, there is no self. It's just a delusion that leads to clinging, which is the cause of suffering, of dukkha. So, okay, whew, that's relief. But this leads to some problems. Like, who do you see in the mirror? Who is it that's brushing your teeth? We have a sense of self. Should we discard that? Because that can be useful sometimes. More significantly, from a Dharma point of view, what is it that might become enlightened? Or no more freedom, even a little bit more freedom. What carries karma? What's responsible for karma? So certainly in many contexts, the Buddha talked as if self was real. I'm going to come back to this later. So the Buddha often talked about the quality of self as being illusory, but he also pointedly avoided talking about self when asked point blank. So as an example, here's a sutta that I read anytime I get an excuse. It's from Samyutta Nikaya 44.10, and it's called, interestingly, the Ananda Sutta. Ananda was the Buddha's personal attendant for many years, for decades, and sometimes acted as a comic foil for the Buddha, as I think he sort of does here. So then the wanderer Vachagata, I love that name, yes. Vachagata, do it to get a drink around here. But by the way, Vachagata comes and goes a lot. Eventually he becomes a follower of the Buddha and becomes enlightened. You'll be glad to know. Then the wanderer Vachagata went to the Blessed One. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he asked the Blessed One, "Now then, Venerable Gotama, is there a self?" When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. "Then there is a self." "Then there is no self?" A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then Vachagata, the wanderer, got up from his seat and left, probably rolling his eyes. Then not long after, Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer?" "Ananda, if I were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, the view that there is an eternal, unchanging soul. If I were to answer that there is no self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism, the view that death is the annihilation of consciousness. If I were to answer that there is a self, would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self?" "No, Lord." "And if I were to answer that there is no self, the bewildered Vachagata would become even more bewildered. Does the self I used to have now not exist?" So he refuses to answer the question directly, because either answer would confuse Vachagata. And he doesn't even tell Ananda the answer. He just tells Ananda his rationale for his lack of an answer. Now, some people argue that there are two extremes that are being rejected there. The eternal unchanging soul on the one hand, and the annihilationism that there's no rebirth, no actions that have moral consequences. So that maybe the Buddha is somewhere in between. Well, I've got another one that I'd like to read that is even more explicit. And this is one where he's talking to the monks. So he's already talking to people who are committed followers of his teachings. This is from Majjhima Nikaya number 2. And I don't think it has a name. I call it the Thicket of Views Sutta. You'll see. "There is the case where an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person does not discern what ideas are fit for attention and what ideas are unfit for attention. This is how he attends inappropriately. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what was I in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I be in the future?" Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the immediate present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where is it bound? As he attends inappropriately in this way, one of six kinds of view arises in him. The view that I have a self arises in him as true and established, or the view I have no self, or the view it is precisely by means of self that I perceive self, Or the view, it is precisely by means of self that I perceive not self. Or the view, it is precisely by means of not self that I perceive self arises in him. Or else he has a view like, this very self of mine, the knower that is sensitive here and there to the ripening of good and bad actions, is the self of mine that is constant, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will stay just as it is for eternity. This is called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a writhing of views, a fetter of views. So I wonder what he really thought. So what he's saying is that not self as a view is just as confusing as self as a view. And I think he's implying, although he's not explicit about this, that if you cling to the view of no self, you create a subtle sense of self. Or to quote Ed Brown, no self, that's for me. So the Buddha actually doesn't say no self, that there is no self. He refuses to answer. And he explains why he doesn't answer this sutta in another great sutta that I'm going to read. I'm going to have to skim part of it because it gets pretty repetitive. This is the Poison Arrow Sutta. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 63. So a monk complains to the Buddha that he doesn't teach answers to certain metaphysical questions. And so the Buddha responds, it's just as if a man were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives would provide him with a surgeon, and the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether this man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or golden colored, his home village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring was fiber, bamboo threads, sinew, hemp, or bark, whether the shaft was wild or cultivated, whether the feathers of the shaft were of a vulture, stork, hawk, or peacock, or another bird, whether I know whether, and he goes on and on and on. And you can imagine that the monks are sort of nudging each other and giggling, because he's really belaboring this point. And I think he's making fun of the whole thing. So, you know, the Buddha, I think he had a sense of humor. So the man would die, and those things, all about the wood and the shooter and so on, would still remain unknown to him. So remember, what is undeclared by me is undeclared, and what is declared by me is declared, and what is undeclared by me, this is the point. I know it took a while. It's almost worth it. What is undeclared by me, the cosmos is eternal, is undeclared by me. The cosmos is not eternal, is undeclared by me. The cosmos is finite. The cosmos is infinite. The body and the soul are the same. The soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a tathagata exists. And some people translate that as a self. After death, a tathagata does not exist. After death, a tathagata both exists and does not exist. After death, a tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, is undeclared by me. And why are they undeclared by me? Because they are not connected with the goal, are not fundamental to the holy life. They do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, calming, direct knowledge, self-awakening, unbinding. That's why they are undeclared by me. And what is declared by me? This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. This is the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. It's the Four Noble Truths. Although he uses stress. This translator, which is Tanisaro Bhikkhu, prefers stress over suffering. So he doesn't answer because it doesn't help with the fundamental issue of ending dukkha. And that's interesting because dukkha is very personal. I mean, who's suffering dukkha? It's us. personally. You know, no self, no problem. So the Buddha often talks about self as if it does exist. And it's like giving Dear Abby advice. And he does that a lot to all kinds of people. And it's off very personal stuff. How to be happy, have good for lay people, it's things like have a good job and a nice family and good digestion. And follow the five precepts. So he's very big on personal advice. So maybe what we can say is that the self fundamentally doesn't exist, but in a mundane or provisional way, it does exist. And this seems to solve some problems, and many teachers have adopted this approach. Ajahn Amaro once told not really a story, but I thought it was very funny. He said that the self is a part of an ongoing universal process. But if a cop pulls you over in your car and he asks you who you are, you really should just hand him your license. He's not going to like it if you talk about being part of a universal unfolding process. One teacher was asked once, is the self real? And the teacher answered, the self is real, but it's not really real. But the Buddha never said anything about there being sort of two levels of reality, about these two layers of self and not self. It seems like it would be important enough that he would say something. Tanisaro Bhikkhu, by the way, makes this point. A number of other points that I'm making here are from his book, Self and Not Selves, which I recommend very highly. So another problem with this two-layered approach to the problem of self and not self is where would we draw the line between these absolute and relative realities? So what Tanisaro Bhikkhu says is that it's really not about metaphysical assertions or absolute truths. It's about skillful versus unskillful action. It's skillful to see the self not as a thing, but an action. Self is not who we are. Self is something that we do. So self should be thought of as a verb rather than a noun. So paraphrasing Tanisaro Bhikkhu, perception of self is an action of creating me and mine. And I find this to be very useful. So if self is an action, the Buddha spoke consistently. He didn't talk about there being two levels of self, a real self and a not real self. He did talk a lot about skillful action and unskillful action. Not relative and absolute views of anatta. So the real question, I think, is when is it skillful to have a view of self and when is it unskillful? Or what is a skillful view of self? Here's a quote from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. A sense of self is an important part of the practice, especially a sense of self that encourages responsibility, heedfulness, and care. So I suggest that brushing your teeth involves a skillful view of self. Ethical behavior is a skillful action that involves the self. After all, if there is no self, why should you behave yourself, as it were? Here's another quote from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. As a first step in putting an end to this suffering, you have to bring awareness to the process by which you create your sense of self so that you can clearly see what you're doing and why it's causing that suffering. That is, you're actually creating yourself moment by moment, and you're free to make choices. You're free to make choices in how you work with that continued creation of self. How? Mindfulness, the duct tape of the spiritual life. So meditation is what develops the mindfulness. You guys all know that. the steadiness of mind and the focus you need to perceive this freedom and act out of your intentions rather than act out of automatic pilot. Or as we heard from some convicts who were here a couple of years ago, finding that space between anger and violence, between craving and using, or developing enough mindfulness to find that space between skillful and unskillful selfing. So I have found this practice to be very helpful. Not that I've become a better person, but at least I've been able to observe the creation of self and how it leads directly to dukkha. How, when I start making it a story about myself, it leads to stress or other problems. So I took a long way around to work our way back to rebirth, the issue of past and future lives. So, what about rebirth? Is it necessary for enlightenment? There are a couple of things that the Buddha says that leave open some possibilities for us moderns and us skeptics. This is the Kalama Sutta. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya 3.65. I don't know what Kalama means. This is an excerpt. When that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, uncorrupted and purified, they've won four consolations in the present life. If it turns out there is another world and good and bad deeds have a result, then when the body breaks up after death, I'll be reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. This is the first consolation that they've won. If it turns out there is no other world and good and bad deeds don't have a result, then in the present life, I'll keep myself free of enmity and ill will, untroubled and happy. This is the second consolation they've won. If it turns out that bad things happen to people who do bad things, then since I have no bad intentions and since I'm not doing anything bad, how can suffering touch me? This is the third consolation they've won. If it turns out bad things don't happen to people who do bad things, then I still see myself pure on both sides. This is the fourth consolation they've won. When that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, undefiled and purified, they've won these four consolations in the present life. I love that. That's a lot like Pascal's wager, for those of you who are familiar with it. Pascal said pretty much the same thing, but using heaven and hell rather than a future lifetime. Now, many people that I love and respect believe very deeply in rebirth, and I'm still on the fence. I've heard interesting information on both ways. We had an experience some 10 years ago, I think, spending a day with a Burmese monk named Piyadamo, German-born, who'd been in Southeast Asia at that point for 10 years. And he said that Buddhism makes no sense without rebirth because there isn't enough suffering in this life to make it worth all that practice. Right, that was our reaction. I mean, if you can't find enough suffering in this life, you're not paying attention. And yet this guy, well, anyway, he's a monk, but he's sort of banking on rebirth because he can't find enough suffering in this life. Very interesting. So I had a realization recently. Past lives or past years or future lives or future years in some ways are pretty much the same. Whether you're planning for the next week or for the next seven lifetimes, how would your actions be different? Would you really behave differently if you're being mindful about your actions? Similarly, looking back over your own life, or I mean, since most of us don't know our past lives because we're not enlightened, how would the knowledge, the abstract knowledge that our past lives, how would that change your view of your own past? You can't change the past years or lifetimes, so they're very similar. The future years or lifetimes are abstract. They don't exist yet. And you can plan for the future in this lifetime or for multiple lifetimes if you like, but that's a little different. What you can do, which is useful, is cultivate intention. But again, how would the cultivating of intention be different from the rest of your life versus multiple lifetimes? I know for you it might be. But for me, only in this moment do I have real volition. Do I have actual choice? Do I have actual control over what might happen in the future? And so in some ways, I don't have to worry about future lives or even how many years I'm going to live. What I have control over is this moment. Your actions in this moment are all that you really own. And your actions shape the coming year or the coming lifetime, right now. Only in this moment do you have that real volition. So there are two big things that I'd like to restate here. Notice there are a lot of issues about death and life that I really didn't touch on. And one, of course, is that death itself, the presence of one's own death, can be a helpful practice. I've sometimes found it helpful just to say, in 50 years, nobody will know the difference. 50 years, I'll be dead, and sure enough, people probably won't know the difference. I won't, certainly. So sometimes just knowing of your own death, you know, you're really involved in something that's some kind of grungy, annoying thing, just reminding yourself that you're going to be dead eventually can actually be a relief. You know, this is like minor stuff. So, I wanted to restate that wise practice sees self as an activity, not as an object. And observing that activity is a very powerful practice. Just being able to notice how we start telling stories immediately when bad stuff happens. Somebody in the cuts us off in traffic. Why does this happen to me? Again, a quote from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. In the attainment of awakening, you put aside both self and not self. So we can see the practice of self versus not self and selfing as being a tool, not as being ultimate truth. Not as being some kind of metaphysical, ontological assertion that we have to believe or not believe. And then the other thing that I talked about is that only in this moment can free will be exercised. Only here can we connect the past to the future, whatever we think the past and future might hold. So we have a little bit of time for questions and discussion. Does this thing work?
Yep.
Great. You want to act as a microphone monkey?
Sure.
Thank you. I have two questions. One comment and question. My comment is, I work with Donald Goldberg, teaches about the process of selfing. You can notice when you have a thick sense of self and a thin sense of self, and you can watch what creates the thickening. But my question is, the very first quote you read about the Ananda Sutta, it seems to me that the answer that I'm most satisfied with is at the end of that, he said something about, is the self that I was still here?
Right.
And to me, that explains that the reason that he doesn't answer, is there a self or is there no self, is that it's the concept of self, as you said, is a process, which to me means it's ever-changing. So we're not the self we were when we were 7 years old, and we're not the self we'll mm-hmm. be tomorrow. So I'm very comfortable with the understanding that self exists, but not as an unchanging, permanent thing, as an ever-changing, mm-hmm. ever-evolving, moment-by-moment concept. That's how I define self. And I'm the end of that first sutta that you read was like, yes, that's what I believe. Mm-hmm. It's there, but it's not what we think it is. It's ever-changing and evolving.
Yeah, I love that. And there are other suttas where the Buddha pointedly avoids answering metaphysical questions and when he does explain, it's generally because he feels that he's just going to leave people more confused than he does by not answering.
But I heard an answer at the end of that session.
Yes, right, right. Although the Buddha didn't say it, but right. No, I love it that Vajragada said that.
And it's very Jewish in that you answer a question with a question.
Yes.
But was that myself? Yes and no. That was myself then, but it's not mm-hmm. myself now.
Great. Anyone? Because I'm perfectly happy to end early.
Do they ever talk about, in the suttas, is there such a thing as like a collective self? And the reason I ask that is because as I live longer, when things happen, like the violence this weekend, even though it's not my personal self.
Mm-hmm. I think what the Buddha would, where the Buddha would go with that, I think would be about compassion. I don't believe he says anything anywhere about collective self. I think that that it would not fit in with at least what I know of what he talked about. He did talk a lot about personal responsibility and about cultivating compassion. And I think that's when you spoke that, what resonated for me was the sense of compassion that we can all share.
Well, and then also there's something about energetically, you know, like the web of life or something, and mm-hmm. energetically how things impact, how things that happen impact one another.
Well, certainly the Buddha saw us all as being radically contingent, all interdependent in a way, and certainly it would make sense within that context for us to have a shared experience, in the sense that we all see this from a distance. And that's one of the remarkable things about modern life, is that we can have compassion for people across the continent or even around the world, that which would have been unthinkable 1,000 years ago.
It seemed like all of the quotes you read, he didn't answer whether there was a self or not. But I thought you started out, and I've heard, that one of his radical teachings is that there's no Atman, there's no soul.
Right. Well, you know, he at times, and I did not bring the sutta to read it, he uses the metaphor of a dog on a leash tied to a stake in the ground, running around in a circle. He says, this is like somebody who is wrapped up in the sense of self, is that they're running around in a circle. And he also used sort of a dialectic methodology to sort of deconstruct the sense of self. He used the analogy of a carriage. He said, well, you are the wheels the carriage? No. Is the axle the carriage? No. And he also very explicitly says you can look at the five aggregates, and sense contact, is form contact the self? No. Pleasant versus unpleasant the self? Is perception the self? Is consciousness the self? And I think this is not inconsistent with what he's saying, that you can't look at any single thing and say that it's yourself, or even a collection of things, because it's something a little bit more complicated than just a collection. It's not just that you're a sack of stuff and that you can pull them out. If you were something definable like that, would it mean, say, if you forgot something, would you be a different person? If you're lost your a finger in an accident, would you be a different person? You can't define yourself in any clear way like that. And I think he said that often. And I think that's not inconsistent. But on the other hand, he did have the sense of you are responsible for your karma and no one else is. So, yes, I didn't go into a lot of the classic teachings, and that might have been fun. I would have, had more suttas to read.
But you're saying he's talking about the soul, not just the false sense of self, but neither the false sense
right.
of self nor the
soul. He certainly, right, he certainly did not buy into the idea of there being any kind of permanent soul that lasted. So it's very, the whole thing of what's reborn gets very tricky because of that. Because, of course, even with Hindus, you don't tend to remember your past lives generally. So is it yourself that goes over, but not any memories? So, what does that mean functionally? Not clear at all. I personally don't like the idea of a Christian heaven because I'm kind of tired of myself. I don't want to go into another lifetime or another realm with the same opinions and the same memories and stuff. I'm ready to let go of that and try something new.
Okay. A very silly question.
My favorite.
Well, maybe it's not silly, but very basic. So, most of my Dharma practice has been about learning to be present in this moment. And not, as is my family conditioning, to be tied up in the past and the future. And so, why do I care about rebirth?
It's a good question.
Why do I care about what?
Rebirth. Why would she care about rebirth since she's really focused on being in the present moment?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great question. And I think for some people it matters a great deal. For me, I think it doesn't matter, and I don't have to have a belief one way or the other, because again, what I have control over is this moment. And I can cultivate intentions for the future. I can try to become a better person. In some ways, I'm thinking about the future when I do that. But cultivating my intention, as I said, whether it's for a lifetime in the future or just for the coming year, it's really the same. I would like to be a better person. I cultivate the intention to be a better person and to be more mindful. And I use mindfulness in this moment, in my experience right now, to try to move in that direction. So I have an intention. You could even say it's almost a goal. It's maybe not that firm. So I have an intention, but I couldn't even do that unless I'm able to participate fully in my experience in the moment. Because otherwise, the ability to choose, it's gone like that. It's sort of like, oh, what did I just do? I just said something really stupid. Or oh, I shouldn't have done that. It's like, it's the mindfulness that gives us the ability to act out of our deepest intentions, out of our values, rather than just react like we're on automatic pilot, like Pavlov's dogs. So I think it sounds like your practice is great. That's what I'm trying to do as well. Ron back there.
Thank you very much. I'm struggling with something, and I really would appreciate your thoughts about this. So I can start with your very deep question and wonder whether the reason that we might care about the question of rebirth or not could be viewed as a parallel to, in ways for me of understanding the complexity of what Buddha was deliberately not answering is solved, quote unquote, by going back to the present moment, because in any single moment, any one of those things might be truer or less true. And therefore, by the time the answer is framed, it's no longer that instant either. So is it a true statement? Who knows? But then I started wondering about, this may be just overly complexifying things, but that's what I do, is the whole notion of present moment, which I too think about a lot, is vexing in the same way, in that, is there really a present moment? Is it true that there wouldn't be a way of having a present moment if it weren't in contradistinction to something else? And as soon as there's something else, there's something that is not a present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the past and the future don't exist, then there isn't anything other than a present moment. So why are we calling it a present moment? It's everything. And there is.
All right. Well, that's two questions, I think, I'm hearing. Many questions. I think, first of all, I didn't touch on, a lot of people treat rebirth, reincarnation, as something that, it's the metaphor that's often used is of a wheel, but many people talk about rebirth as something that happens moment by moment, or day by day, and that there can be wheels within wheels. And so the rebirth model can be useful as a moment-to-moment or day-to-day or year-to-year set of events. I mean, it's oversimplifying things, of course, that you can watch the birth of self and the death of self. You know, I walk down the street and I see this wonderful drum set in the window of a store. Oh, I'd love to have that drum set. I deserve that drum set. You know, I can imagine myself playing that drum set. I've just given birth. I can't afford the drum set. You know, I've just experienced a death. You know, a whole lifetime, a whole spinning of the wheel has just taken place there. In about 30 seconds, it took me to walk past that store window. I think the second thing is the whole problem of if this instant is so instantaneous that there's something rather abstract about it. So I think it's make me more helpful to think of it as a matter of what's helpful for my practice. And one thing I did through this is to come back to practice issues, because that's what we do in Marin Sanghas. We talk about the Dharma in daily life. So it may be that when we're in this moment, experiencing this moment, that there is some kind of illusion even there. But most of us have had the experience of suddenly finding that freedom between a stimulus and a response and actually choosing to behave differently than we would normally and having a choice where we didn't before. This is such a common experience. Even these convicts talked about it, about finding that moment between anger and violence, between craving and using, between the irritation from your in-law and then saying something stupid that just makes things worse and just shutting up instead. So I think that's where the notion of this moment becomes useful. Maybe it doesn't make sense from an abstract point of view, but it makes great sense from a practice point of view. So I think we're going to end there. So we can just take a moment and breathe again.